Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
You find yourself in the kitchen. You see an eclair in the receptacle. And you think to yourself, what the hell? I'll just eat some trash.
How do I call thee trash? Let me count the ways.
Garbage.
Waste.
Rubbish.
Junk.
Litter.
Dregs.
It was not trash.
What makes something trash?
Was it in the trash?
Yes.
Then it was trash.
What can we learn about ourselves by examining what we throw away?
Doesn't our trash reflect our values as much as our treasures?
It was in a magazine and it still had the doily on.
Was it eaten?
One little bite.
Well, that's garbage.
Do the things we call trash say more about the thing or more about us?
Our guest is Elizabeth Spellman, author of Trash Talks, Revelations in the Rubbish.
The Philosophy of Trash.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
How much of today's treasure is destined to be tomorrow's trash?
Are growing piles of trash just the price we pay for progress?
Or do our trashy habits amount to an ecological terrorism?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Deborah Satz. And we're here at the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Deborah and I both teach philosophy. And today our conversation is about the philosophy of trash.
So, Ken, did you know that the average American produces about 4.5 pounds of trash a day? That's an astounding 8 tons of trash a year. Why do we make so much garbage?
Well, Deborah, I think you have to think of it as the price we pay for progress. I mean, today's trash was yesterday's treasure, and today's treasure will be tomorrow's trash. And that's just how civilization works.
No, it's not. It's how capitalism works. That's not progress. It's wasteful. It's an assault on the earth.
Oh, Deborah, come on. You know, you haven't read your Plato? We desire things. We're repetitive creatures. It's human nature to want new things, better things, more efficient things. By the way, Deborah, I have to say, that's a lovely new sweater you're wearing there.
Point taken, Ken. But it's not human nature that led me to buy this sweater. It was clever advertising and marketing. And it's products designed to break down or become obsolete every year that makes me keep buying. Do you really think it took them 10 tries to get the iPhone right?
Well, Deborah, that's called innovation. And without innovation, we'd be stuck in the Stone Age.
Look, I'm not against innovation, but I'm against the vicious cycle of pointless consumption.
Vicious cycle of pointless consumption? Well, that's a mouthful, Deborah.
You know, it might be a mouthful, but the fact is that businesses create new stuff and they make us want it. And then we buy the stuff and then they create more stuff. And then we want that too. And then they get rich and the earth gets screwed. Ken, all of this unbridled consumption has just got to stop.
Just stop, code? Come on, Deborah. If we stop buying and consuming, well, then economies will stop growing. And then what do we have? We'll have a world that's poor, gray. It'll be a wretched place. You don't really want that, do you?
No. And I said unbridled consumption. I'm not saying all consumption is bad or that all trash is bad.
Okay, so then how do we decide? How do we decide between the good trash and the bad trash? Look, you may be perfectly content with things that are old and slow, but I got to tell you, I want the latest and the fastest. I really do.
You know, Ken, it's not just about what you want. We have to think together about our collective impact on the planet. We've got a fragile ecosystem.
Look, don't get me wrong, Deborah. I care about the planet. I care about it, too. I religiously recycle. I compost. Come on.
Well, it's great that you do that. And in fact, about a third of America's trash is recycled.
See?
But it's not enough. Eventually, the rest of the world is going to start consuming at the rate we do now. And then the world is going to be buried in trash, no matter what we do with recycling.
Well, then we got to make sure that the rest of the world doesn't start consuming at our level, don't we?
It's just unbelievable that you said that.
Wait a minute. That was a joke. Come on, chill.
Really funny. Okay, jokes aside, then how do we address both world poverty and our consumption? How do we keep consuming without destroying the planet?
Well, hand-me-downs, Deborah. Hand-me-downs. No, seriously. When I was a kid, I loved my older brother's hand-me-downs. And my wife and I, when we were poor, starving graduate students, we furnished our apartments with lots of cool, used stuff, essentially hand-me-downs. So hand-me-downs.
Wait a second. You're the guy who always wants the latest and the fastest.
Well, I'm willing to hand stuff down.
Yeah, but other people don't want your trash. And they don't want your hand-me-downs.
Well, but look, you got it. I'm trying to envision like a paradigm shift here, Deborah. Look, instead of seeing old stuff as dirty, useless trash we just throw away, maybe we need to think of it as stuff, you know, you use for a while, and then you lovingly pass on to somebody else like hand-me-downs.
So if I get you right, what you're saying is it's time to trash the very concept of trash as we know it.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Deborah. Exactly. And to give us a feel for how that might work, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to Recology San Francisco. Now, that's a very special dump where so-called trash is recycled, composted, taken to the landfill, and sometimes turned into art. She files this report.
At the San Francisco dump, our waste is sorted into hills. Some bulky, some more granular, some wet, some fermenting. There's also an artist studio here, filled with treasures culled from the household drop-offs outside.
I seem to be really attracted to the colorful things, so I feel like I'm a little bit of a magpie, like in that big pile.
Beth Krebs is one of this season's artists in residence. The materials she salvages will be worked into an exhibition over 4 months. Her side of the studio is bright and pretty. A dump is the last thing it brings to mind.
I've been collecting a lot of different fluorescent construction mesh.
There's patterned linoleum.
A swim noodle.
A tower of shiny plastic trays.
It's a pile of cake boxes that are just so pretty, I don't know what to do with them.
She doesn't know what she'll make with any of it yet. Right now, she just feels lucky to get to spare them from what would have been their fate.
Just to see day after day that just the volume of stuff coming in is, like, I think we're pretty kept from that. Like, we put our stuff on the side of the road and it goes away.
In San Francisco, there's actually only less than 10 things that can't be recycled or composted. Toothpaste tubes, medical gloves, ceramics, soiled diapers, just a few others. And yet, because people don't perfectly follow the rules, there's a football-sized trash dump at Recology, destined for the landfill.
It's sobering, I think.
The artists don't scavenge among the landfill pile. That hill is as alive as we are, teeming with microscopic organisms that thrive on zero oxygen, breaking down our waste and exhaling methane back into the air we breathe. Leaching out a garbage espresso that can seep and contaminate our water. We try to rid ourselves of our trash, but it's here.
It's fascinating. It's, you know, it's almost like being on an archaeological dig of, you know, some species that's long gone, but we're still right here.
On the other side of the artist studio is Rodney Ewing. His palette is much more somber. He's focused in on the remnants of the changing city, construction materials from demolished homes.
Like the lath that's right here, the sheetrock, the cabinetry, pieces of Luand.
These materials got him thinking about what's happening in his neighborhood.
There's a lot of displacement, there's a lot of gentrification going on, there's a lot of houses being torn down, and also the area where I work, every block seems to be a construction zone.
He's come to think of trash on a bigger scale, in terms of what the city mines and digests and expels from its neighborhoods.
By collecting all these materials, I really should be honoring the spirit of the materials and the spirit of, like, the housing and where they were torn from, and in some ways trying to preserve them in some kind of way.
Ewing is still working out his vision, but whatever it is, it will give a second life to the materials laid waste here. The art produced in past residencies has been shown in galleries around the city. Some of it has even been turned into music. One former Recology artist, Nathaniel Stuckey, created instruments from the materials he scavenged during his residency. Then he composed a piece of music that's since been performed in a bunch of places, including by the San Francisco Youth Symphony. You're listening to it now. And that's how one city's trash becomes its symphony's treasure. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Beer.
Liza, thanks for that really cool dive into a really cool dump. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Deborah Satz. And today we're thinking about what we can learn from our trash.
We're joined by Elizabeth Spellman, professor of philosophy at Smith College. She's the author of Trash Talks, Revelations in the Rubbish. Vicki, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. And it's great to have you. So, Vicki, it took me a while to see, when we were contemplating this show, that trash could be a really interesting topic for philosophers. I assume it didn't take you very long, but how did you first get interested in the topic of garbage?
Well, I am very aware of the kinds of issues you're talking about, though, as you know, my book really doesn't touch on them very directly. I got interested in it in part through some connections you've already made. My earlier work on repair left me exceedingly aware of how much the kind of atrophying of our capacities to repair, the failure of corporations to make things that can be repaired easily so that, that you may have to buy new things, that contributed a lot to all the waste, which anyone with their eyes open or their noses working, if their eyes don't work very well, know that we make a whole lot of waste and garbage and so forth. So that made me open to that, but I'd also been teaching a course for some time on desire, especially in the context of a consumer society, which ties in with some of your earlier comments there. Spent a lot of time on Plato, and Ken, I have to say right away, Plato certainly was worried about the appetitive part of the soul, the desiring part. Well, all parts of the soul have, but these appetitive desires, which are insatiable, meaning lots of different things. But he never was concerned about trash or waste or anything else, at least in the senses we are. However, he provides us with an extremely interesting analysis of the depth of dissatisfaction in which we live. And, of course, from a Buddhist perspective, too, one of the big problems that we have as people who are subject to craving and the ignorance that typically goes with craving about the impermanence of the objects of our craving is that we're in a state of dissatisfaction. So I thought, wow, hello?
Yeah, let me just break in for a second on, so you've been talking about desire, but let's just back up for a second and just, can you say something about what exactly is trash? I mean, it's clearly not what philosophers call a natural kind. That's something that's carved into the DNA of the world. So what is it that makes something garbage? Is it just that we don't want it anymore?
Well, trash and garbage are not necessarily synonymous, by the way. In fact, we get a reminder of that when someone says in the household, would you please put that garbage in the trash? And junk, there's a big lexicon. Sometimes they're synonymous, sometimes they aren't. But what marks something I think as trash is the attitude we take towards it, the actions that we take towards it. And of course, it can be a person as well as an object. And precisely because it's in a sense not part of the DNA of the world around us, that's why something that is someone's trash can become someone's treasure, or as Ken reminded us too, it can go the other way. And we see in the life of secondhand and thirdhand objects and so forth, that kind of coming and going, of going in and out, of being considered trash or rubbish or something like that. But I got very interested in that way, and I couldn't help but notice how much of our everyday language is just chock full with references to junk or trash or so forth. So, for example, I'm hoping you guys and your wonderful listeners won't early on or by the end of the hour think, what a waste of time, right?
Yeah,
we know people use that, right? Very, very common. It's a reminder of how much the kind of trash lexicon is part of our lives. Philosophers, as we know, love to say that other philosophers' work is rubbish. And if they can say it with a British accent, it's really going to hurt.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about trash with Vicki Spellman from Smith College.
What does our trash say about us? The German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach said we are what we eat. Should he have said we are what we throw away?
Our bodies, ourselves, and our trash. When Philosophy Talk continues. Now, you don't have to be a grouch who lives in a garbage can to think that there's more to trash than meets the eye. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and we're thinking about trash. Our guest is Vicki Spellman from Smith College, and she's the author of Trash Talks, Revelations in the Rubbish.
So, Vicki, I think of your book as in this unique genre. I call it the hermeneutics of garbage. That is the interpretation. Hermeneutics is a fancy word meaning something like interpretation of garbage. So what can we learn about ourselves from interpreting our garbage? What's the most prominent or striking thing you think we can learn from interpreting our garbage?
Well, one of the things we're familiar with is going through the trash to get the dirt on people. You stand in line in a supermarket and you read, you know, the trashy literature there at the checkout, and you notice that such and such a celebrity's trash has been gone through and all this stuff has been revealed. And it turns out that this happens all the time, and in fact there have been cases of that have gone to the Supreme Court of the United States, a famous one that happened in Southern California to start with, by the way, cops wondering if somebody was dealing drugs and going through their garbage and then being able to get a warrant and so forth. That's pretty interesting that we think that people's trash is deeply revelatory of them, perhaps especially of things that they wish weren't known, though that's not necessarily the case.
So do you think that, are we trying to reveal ourselves in our trash? Like, do people throw things away to show that they have a lot to throw away?
They might do that, or they might, rather than wanting people to go through their trash, they might, as the members of the leisure class that Thorstein Veblen wrote so wonderfully about in The Theory of the Leisure Class. He's the guy who brought us the concept of conspicuous consumption. They don't want to raise their social status. They want you to know not what's in their trash, but they're capable of being wasteful. They can buy much more than they need. They can have much bigger houses and much bigger cars than they need. They can have lots of people around them. So that is certainly something where we want to show.
Vicki, I get the concept of conspicuous consumption. I want to buy a big house, not just to live in it, but so that people can see that I have a big house, so that they can say, well, he's a really high-status guy, right?
Are you also suggesting— You could be president of the United States.
Yeah. Are you also suggesting, though, that I want, as a symbol of my status, I want conspicuous disposal of, like, lots of stuff? Like I'm a profligate?
No.
I'm not quite sure what the connection between conspicuous consumption and conspicuous trashing is.
Here we go. Here's a wonderful example of the different senses of waste, because on the one hand there's waste which we think of as more or less synonymous with trash. Sometimes it's that way: throw it in the waste can, throw it in the trash can. Other times, though, it's the sense that I have enough that I can waste it, but I'm not going to waste it. I'm not going to throw out my house. I want you to see that I'm not living in conditions of scarcity, that I can afford, and you can't, to have much more than I need, even though someone might well say, hey, that's a waste of space. Do you really need a closet that big?
Right. So, I mean, one of the things that seems to happen is because there's conspicuous consumption, because we're always thinking relatively about how much we consume with respect to other people and wanting to show we're on top, that just generates a lot of waste because I got to keep getting bigger and better. Like Ken wanted newer, shinier, better things. And if I'm going to get newer, better things, then something's got to happen to the old things, and they mostly wind up in the dump.
Well, and going back to the notion of dissatisfaction, one of the things I began to see, and it fits in with some of your earlier comments, I think, Deborah, at the top of the hour, that dissatisfaction, as much as Plato and Buddha were worried about it, it in fact is the calling of consumers right now in hyper-consumerist societies like the United States. We are expected to be dissatisfied, not immediately, but you've had that iPhone and you liked it for a while, but It's your job. It's a kind of emotional labor as consumers that we do to develop dissatisfaction and disdain and disgust and say, I got to get a new one.
So I take your point. I think that's a very well taken point. But that sounds like both you and Deborah are suggesting that our very mode of production, our capitalist mode of production, because here's how I think the good capitalists work. They don't think of satisfying antecedently existing desires that we know that we have. They do that, but they also like anchor our desires to the products that they create to give us new focused desires that we didn't have before. I didn't want an iPhone until Steve Jobs says, I'm going to put that in your hands and you're going to play with it and you're going to want it. And then they make me want more and they make me want more and they make me want more. But people say that creates wealth. I mean, that's the secret to wealth creation. Are you and Deborah saying we should just stop with wealth creation?
By the way, Steve Jobs at one point even said, I'm going to tell you what you want. I mean, he came out and actually said that, I believe. Wealth for whom? There is a restoration economy that has to do with, you know, fixing things, not the same as recycling and so forth. But if we're so damn smart, being the products of intelligent design, not of wasteful evolution, why can't we come up with other ways of not only of creating wealth, but of sharing wealth? When people talk vaguely about creating wealth, for whom?
Yeah, so Vicky, there are two issues that I want to separate out. There's the fact that wealth and our consumption has bad effects on the planet. And then there's, is it bad for us? Which is could be totally independent. So when you talk about the Buddha and desire, you're really talking about, is it a good human life to spend your life in consumption? That's independent of its ecological effects. So are you saying both? Is it bad for the planet? Is it bad for us? Or is it one or the other? Or how should I think about this?
Okay, well, at this point, it certainly seems to be pretty bad for the planet, but not only bad for the planet, but bad for hundreds of thousands of probably millions of people around the planet where all our e-waste is dumped or our garbage ends up and so forth. But whether it's good or bad for us, that's for us to continue to think about and look at in very specific situations. We know that one of the things that Plato worried a lot about, and I think it's worth the consideration, that a person who is in thrall to her appetitive desires is kind of being, you know, we become the colony, as you were mentioning almost in these words earlier on, Deborah, we become, in a sense, our desires become the colonial outpost of people who want us to want things. And the question is, sometimes maybe that's okay, other times maybe it's not. Are we willing, workers for an economy that counts on us to want, almost no matter the end point? I agree they're two different questions, and they have to be looked at differently.
So Vicky, I think you and Deborah are into something important, but I do want to stress, I think you would both agree with this. It's not just like the desires are there and given and like and insisting to be satisfied. I mean, that's one thing. We do have a lot of fundamental desires that are there, given, and we must satisfy because, you know, it's part of the human nature. But I think a late capitalist economy has gotten extraordinarily expert at creating desire. And the question is, should unbridled desire creation just be?
And if not, why? I mean, there's something great, I think, as Ken was explaining, there's something great about having more desires, creating more desires in people. If we hold away the question of its effects on the planet, in some ways, the creation of many, many desires is the creation of more complex human beings,
right, exactly.
With more
richer
capabilities,
lives, yes.
Richer lives. So
these are the questions that animate the course that off and on now for 4 or 5 years I've taught about desire. Certainly, we're and our students are super aware of the extent to which various, you know, sources, agencies, individuals, institutions want them to want all kinds of things, not just goods, but want them to want a certain way of life, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And one of the questions philosophers of many stripes have asked is, to what extent are one's desires one's own? There's not an easy answer to that. Maybe it's okay if they're not owned, but that's one of the questions I know students also often have, and one might want to reflect on that and the meaning of they're not being mine.
So, Vicky, we got a bunch of callers here. I'd love to have them join this conversation. And William from Belvedere is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, William. What's your comment or question?
Yes, thank you very much. I think I finally get to talk like a philosopher, although I've never even played one on TV.
Okay.
the question that I would raise, it's been portrayed as victimizers and victims. The people that the corporations create, the items, then they convince the public to buy them, even if they're not very necessary items. But I would suggest that those people at the corporations are not just victimizers, they are themselves victims. Because the reason that they want those jobs is because they, indeed, have the same kinds of tastes for excess that they are convincing other people to have when they convince other people to buy their product.
Right. Well, William, that's an interesting thought. I mean, you're saying, I think, and I'll throw this to Deborah and to Vicky, but in a way, William's saying we're all in this together, right? This the economy of desire creation, demand creation, desire satisfaction. But I still go back to Deborah's point. It has enriched human lives.
Yeah, I would also, I think that was an interesting observation, William. I would draw one distinction, which is I think that corporations are much more constrained than consumers are. So corporations need to keep selling products to be more efficient, to outcompete, you know, the competitors. If they don't outcompete, they'll go under. But you and I don't have to buy all the things that we buy. We choose to buy them. And, you know, of course, there's a question. Is there anything wrong with our choosing to buy them? And, you know, the obvious answer is yes, when it imposes a third-party cost on somebody else, which is it destroys the environment. Then there's a further question, is it bad for us to be consuming so much?
So what do you think, Vicky?
Thank you, William, for your call. And you guys for your comments, of course. I think that certainly my students are highly aware of, once again, of the power of corporations and their vulturous advertisers over. At the same time, they, I think, and certainly out in the literature, there's a lot about this, to think of consumers simply as victims, or for that matter, as those people who work for manufacturers and so forth, as victims, may be overstating it, because we are aware, there are more and more ways of becoming aware, and students are aware of that. And I remember, I think it was an essay by Susan Bordo not long ago where she talked about all this influence on young women to look a certain way, buy certain products so you can look a certain way. And her students, Susan reported, looked up, I think it was an article by, and saying, we know all that. So sometimes one can know this and in that sense not be a victim and still think, given the options, maybe
why
that's
not? Yeah.
What I want to do. But, you know, there's at one point in my book, I talk a little bit, remind philosophers and theologians of St. Anselm, who defined God as the being than which nothing better could be conceived. And I think the advertising world constantly, on the one hand, presents objects as those things than which nothing better possibly could be conceived or exist until the next one comes along. And one of the dangers, I think, for us as consumers is that we may think, and I'm becoming a better person. I'm becoming a richer person. Well, maybe not. I don't think there's an easy answer. I think we constantly have to be assessing that and then asking what kind of tools might we develop for assessing that. And thank God, that's one of the things that philosophers, among others, might be pretty good at
So we've got a comment from Howard in San Francisco. Howard observes that part of the big problem is packaging, that we waste so much in unnecessary packaging, and he wonders what can we do to reduce. It's not, I mean, we add to the waste by our wrapping and bows and unneeded cards. And what do we do about that?
And packaging is not just a utilitarian thing. Packaging has to look cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what you see. Yep. You see the packaging. So it's all part of this capitalist production, right? If it's not in a pretty package, you're not going to want it. So
right. And moreover, this happens with a lot of food waste, that fruits and vegetables are given certain shapes so that they can pack as many as possible into the smallest possible container. Or I think one of the things we have to think about is the existence of, and we're living in an age in which more and more people who don't want regulation seem to be getting louder and louder voices, where there be some kind of regulation over packaging.
So one thing that's turned out to be helpful, I think, is if you introduce a fee for using a package. So in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, but also in Ireland, they started charging people for using plastic bags, and the number of plastic bags went way down. Maybe that we ought to be imposing costs on people who throw out more than they need to.
Yes, and the aesthetics in all this, certainly in food waste and so many other kinds of waste too, as I think Ken was getting at, is very crucial. And people can be, I think very young people can become aware very quickly of the wiles, the lures that are being brought them. And more and more young people, I think, even in early grades, are being exposed to what happens with all this stuff. And they sometimes complain to their parents.
Yeah, Figgy, you sound like you're investing a lot of hope in the young. I'm not quite sure I share that hope, but I will remind our listeners you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about trash with Vicki Spellman, author of Trash Talks, Revelations in the Rubbish.
What should we do about all the trash that we're creating? Does a zero trash lifestyle make sense? And even if it makes sense, can we achieve it in our consumerist capitalist society?
What to do about the trash when Philosophy Talk continues. We're picking up the trash and putting it under a philosophical lens. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and our guest is Vicki Spellman from Smith College, the author of Trash Talks, Revelations in the Rubbish. I'd like to start. We have a comment from Joanne in San Francisco, actually a set of comments. Joanne notes that we often confuse the accumulation of trash and stuff with pleasure. And pleasure really, having stuff isn't the same as being happy. And she also points out that with the holidays around the corner, people should consider re-gifting stuff that they don't need or can't use, rather than trashing it.
So what do you think of those thoughts, Vicki?
That sounds very good to me, and there also are alternative ways of wrapping. My older sister many years ago some other friends, doesn't matter who, but would take pillowcases and, wrap things in there and maybe tie a little string around it, and then put the stuff in and then start over again. I do want to, since we're talking about advertising, I want there to be some truth in advertising here. As I think you guys know, because you know my book, I do not write about the huge problems we're facing with trash. Lots of other people do. They do it very well. That's one of the reasons I chose not to do about it. My interest in trash takes another route. I don't, though, for a minute, say that somehow what we're talking about isn't important. It's
so
just
do you
that
have? But
I'm
that,
not the expert to turn to on it.
I know, but I do want to. But you're a philosopher and you're a thoughtful person, and you can help us reimagine the world. So I want to invite you, if you're willing, to help us reimagine a world and how we might get to a world where there's less trash. You have any thoughts about that? How do we get to a world in which there's less trash? Do you have any thoughts?
Yes. Think a lot about, and this is where that cartoon thing that Annie Leonard did that is used in lots of ways. People have lots of questions about it, called The Story of Stuff. I'm sure you many people know about that, where she lays out what it takes, first of all, to, you know, you do to the earth in order to get the materials that you need to make things, what the manufacturing process involves, what the distribution process involves, and then going to the stores and then throwing them away and so forth. So if we think about the path that was created for the things that we have and where it's going next, maybe we would be a lot more careful about what we did. And one other thing, too, I think is very important. I'm sorry, I just want to add one quick thing. Think about who is taking care of this trash. Sanitation workers around the world are often very much in peril. They're treated like trash, rather than, and the S word, and so forth. So think a lot about not just where it's going, but who's dealing with it.
So
it's dangerous work.
So I think that's a good point and important point. But I want to pick up now Ken's side of the argument, which is, you know, for a lot of people in the world, getting more stuff is critical to their well-being. Lots of people don't have enough. And so when we start to think about trash, we also need to think about the distribution of trash. You know, there's going to be waste. No matter what, we're creatures that, you know, create waste. But how it's distributed and how much carrying capacity the Earth has for this, these are really critical questions.
Agreed. Absolutely critical. And again, how much the Earth can carry. But there are one of the conferences I went to some years ago called Waste in the Social Context, some movies came along with that that conference in Alberta. And the images that a few documentary movie makers had made of people in parts of China, parts of South America, and so forth, on whose shores all the damn e-waste that we and the rest of the people in the world create gets dumped on their shores because the regulations aren't followed. They paw through that in order to find materials that they can sell in order to make a living. So that at one at the same time with this kind of activity, which is very widespread, not only is the water supply and the ground and so forth being poisoned, but so are the people who are without any kind of, you know, protective equipment and everything going through it, because that is the way at that point that they can make their life. Now, that's not as bad as, say, the sanitation workers in New York who are, Robin Nagel has written about so well, who will be picking up those bags that, you know, are on the streets of New York, and people will walk by and their dogs will pee on the bags while the trash people are taking care of it.
So Vicky and Deborah, I want to shift topics just briefly. I want to follow up on something that was implicit in Deborah's remarks, but I want to suggest that we're in a kind of existential crisis, and not just a local in the following sense. I think you look at all these sweeping epochs of humankind and how the production has managed, the difference between, you know, agriculture and the hunter-gathering, and then this post-industrial world in which we extract all this energy from the earth through fossil fuels and all that, and that enables us to produce all this stuff. Okay, we're in that age. We are used to, like, a much, 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 much higher standard of living than humans have ever enjoyed in the past.
But in the West.
In the West.
In parts of the world.
Much of the world. And the people that Deborah saw, referred to, looking at us, say, I want that too. Mm-hmm. And what are we to say? Well, you can't have that. I said that in the opening. I was only half joking, but because it's true that if the whole world started consuming at our rate, we'd be in a heck of a trouble, right? We can't do it. Okay, so what do we do? I actually do not know what the answer is. How can we, given human aspirations for consumption and production and the carrying capacity of the earth and those who have been locked out, who want in, how do we manage this? I have no idea how we manage this. Do either of you? I think we're in a deep existential crisis. I think Western civilization is not sustainable on the earth, but I don't know what comes next. Help me imagine what comes next.
Sorry, but it's not the right time to make a joke, but what comes next is we become trash. That is, we extinguish ourselves. Our species is not guaranteed to last forever anyway, but that is the real worry. But more seriously, I think what we might do to deglorify the things that we have. And, you know, there are a lot of studies about, comparative studies of people's quality of life and the criteria that they use in different cultures and so forth to judge their quality of life. Health is always up there. Certainly having access to various kinds of goods are there, and sometimes go back to something that came up earlier, Deborah, you in particular are talking about, and Ken has picked up, say having a cell phone. In India, where so many people still are defecating in public, a woman defecating in public is often, you know, she goes off somewhere, and she's really in possible danger when she does that. Not only is it a pain in the neck to do that with a sari on, but you might be more subject than usual to, you know, prowlers and predators and so forth. And being able to have some kind of means of communication that might make a difference in saving your life. Yeah, sure.
So that's a good example for getting at, I think, what I'll call the dialectic here, which is that on the one hand, you know, we need a concept of enough. Like, what's enough? On the other hand, there's something problematic about the concept of enough, because it's by constantly surpassing what's enough that the human race has progressed. If we were just satisfied with enough, we'd be back in, you know, hunter-gatherer society, living lives that are poor and, you know, short. And we're not, and that's a good thing. But on the other hand, without a concept of enough, we will, you know, possibly destroy the planet.
You got one last closing thought for us on Vicky, on that very somber note?
Only go to book two of The Republic, the conversation between Socrates, Glaucon, and Adeimantus. And the point you were making about enough is precisely what Glaucon says to Socrates after he describes what he takes to be the healthy city. And Glaucon says, well, it's enough, but enough is, I mean, he doesn't use those words, but enough is not enough. That's a city for pigs, not pigs in the sense of eating garbage, but not having the kind of sensitivity we have, the sensibility we have to what pleasures are and so forth. So that's another way I think we can have conversations with each other, with our students and so forth about, I mean, I think maybe you ought to have a whole session on enough.
Well,
in
you
fact,
know what?
You probably can't have enough sessions on enough.
We're almost at enough now.
Yeah, Vicky. Well, this isn't a nearly enough time, but we're out of it for right now. And on that note, on that inspiring note, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thanks very much. And it's Elizabeth V. My mom was Elizabeth. My middle name's Victoria. I've always gone by Vicky, but I sometimes go as Garbage Girl, so, you know.
Okay.
Take your pick.
Our guest has been Vicky Spellman, professor of philosophy from Smith College, author of Trash Talks, Revelations in the Rubbish. So, Deborah, you got some closing thought?
I'm going to recycle my sweater. that's one of my thoughts. You know, I think that there is a dilemma, which is that it's the production of stuff, which produces waste, is part of what moves the world and has made tremendous inroads on poverty, raised the standard of living. But on the other hand, it has huge costs that are not, you know, taken account of. And we need a system design that takes account of the costs we're imposing on the planet.
So I totally agree with you. When there weren't that many of us and we weren't this good at producing excess, as it were, then it didn't have this downside. But we've gotten really good at this, and there were so many of us, and this trick that we have, it's kind of run out. It's kind of run its course. So, but this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is "Cogito ergo blogo." I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community by registering at our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send your question to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on our blog. And now it's time for a high-speed dumpster dive with Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when civilization meets volcanoes, fires, floods, wars, its trash often becomes something else. An artifact, evidence, treasure. The relatives go through the rubble after the disaster, friends, scavengers, and finally the archaeologists. And lo, in 1,000 years, our museums are full of their jugs and crappy little toys Grandpa made from an acorn and dirt, now worth 3 million American on the open market. We love the Greeks and Romans and the pre-Napoleon French look, but we are split. Some of us like the look of old marble and gold, but are creeped out by the antiquity and the fact that these things were once owned by somebody else. This statue is used? Yuck. But these people are okay with plaster replica statues from a mold and copious amounts of spray paint. It's the Las Vegas Donald Trump Disneyland approach to historicity, weathered, distressed, antique to perfection by lifestyle bloggers. Of course, today, epochs come and go on a daily basis. Some things linger on the cultural radar, like baseball cards and Barbies, but others soon outstay their welcome, like Pogs, Garbage Pail Kids, and Cap Guns. There's the overflowing dustbin of history right over there, kids. Even that's a tourist attraction. And sometimes trash remains trash, but yields strangely specific treasures. The self-styled garbologist A.J. Weberman went through Bob Dylan's trash for insights into his catalog. Was Bob eating a Happy Meal the day he recorded Blowing in the Wind? Well, no, because the Happy Meal was invented in 1979, long after folk music hit the dustbin. Still, these are the kinds of historical McNuggets that collectors, fans, consumers, and county fairgoers go all out for. It is amazing the amount of trash we produce. Big balls of garbage gum up the ocean, seagulls get caught in six-pack plastic. We're running out of room to dump our daily output. We even had to invent big smashers to squinch cars down to the size of tables. We have bonfires, deep toxic pits, exacerbated by the fact that things go south a lot quicker than they used to. Transistor radios were the bee's knees in the 1950s. In the historical scheme of things, that's not even yesterday yet. Black and white televisions, color too, VCRs, stationary bikes, rotary phones, reel-to-reel recorders, cassette players, phone booths, analog football stadiums, family values, all gone. The dust heap grows, but there's still an amazing amount of stuff we hang on to, and an astonishing amount of stuff we take home that other people throw away. Sheet music, dolls, baby furniture, Disney crap, bestsellers from 5 years ago. I am quite fond of estate sales and antique malls, on the prowl for toy soldiers from broken sets, old men's magazines with a sweaty guy on the cover rescuing a scantily clad woman from piranhas or Nazis. I like ephemera, programs for high school musicals from 1956, guides to roadside attractions, trade magazines, brochures, flyers, self-published occult novels, tiny books featuring movie stars from the 40s. Also, bad art, Mexican wrestling action figures, Christian comic books. I even took home a foot-high plastic Monty, which guards my landline even as I speak. I have a lot of stuff. Strangely, while I do have scrapbooks, I spend more time looking at photographs I picked up from secondhand bins. Black and whites of old men smiling with dogs, young couples embarrassed by a cake, a young man by an airplane, two girls in a pickup. Eventually, I'll have to move this stuff to a facility. During the ongoing boom in self-storage, my unit will contain a rich history of a culture, the fascinating interests of a man with a tad too much disposable income, and a creepy fascination with other people's stuff. When I die, all of it can be yours. You don't want it? Oh, well, throw it away then. Or put it up on Storage Wars. Is that show still on? I should keep my eye out for a DVD. Used, of course. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Well, you, my friend, have crossed the line that divides man and bum. You are now a bum.